KPCW News time is 8:06. Well, it's just not Sundance, unless we have a little bit of snow falling on Angelinos who showed up without the appropriate gear for the weather. On the phone, I have Nate Larson. Nate, we're going to get some snow?
Glad to bring a little bit of snow, I guess, for Sundance this weekend. We've got a storm system pushing in throughout the evening into tomorrow. So good news for folks up in Park City. The storm system has been a little tricky as far as where the actual band of snow is expected to set up. The trough of low pressure is staying well to the west of us and situating itself over essentially Southern California into the weekend. So as it does, the majority of the moisture will follow it. We will see a decent chance of some snow setting up, though, throughout the afternoon and into Saturday for northern Utah. Temperatures near 34 in Park City today with mostly cloudy skies. We'll see a chance of snowflakes throughout the afternoon and evening. Heaviest snowfall will happen, though, on Saturday. Right now, there haven't been any winter weather advisories issued. It's looking like snow totals are looking a little better, though, for the southern Wasatch Mountain areas, south into some of the central mountains. So the further you are south of Salt Lake County, the better chances you have of decent snowfall. Right now, Park City looking at maybe 2 to 4 inches of snow. 1 to 3 for Heber Valley, just a high of 25 tomorrow. We'll start to see decreasing moisture into Sunday. Temperatures are cold, though. We're going to see teens for overnight lows into tomorrow, about 11 degrees into Sunday with a high of just 31. High pressure takes back over next week. We're not going to see any more snowfall for next week, but we will see temperatures start to rebound under that high pressure ridge. We'll be back above freezing on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We should top out at about 37 degrees on Thursday with overnight lows still in the teens. Heber looking at 37, 19 tonight into tomorrow, 30 degrees for the high on Saturday. Plan on snow showers, 11 degrees into Sunday, partly cloudy. Could see a few snowflakes linger into Sunday. A lot of the moisture should be to the south of us, though. Sunny skies into next week for the Heber Valley. Temperatures will be hovering in the low teens. We'll plan on temperatures in the afternoon right around the upper 30s, 37 Monday, Tuesday, 38 on Wednesday with a high of 40 on Thursday.
So, Nate, you going to sneak up here and catch a movie?
I need to.
Okay.
I need to plan it out. I don't have one scheduled yet.
But. All right. Well, listen, have a good weekend.
You too.
Let's see what's going on in the backcountry. Here with a report is Greg from the Utah Avalanche Center.
Yeah, good morning. You just heard the weather forecast. We are expecting some snow this weekend, but quite a bit of uncertainty exactly how much snow we're going to get. It does seem like the southern Wasatch will do better than further north. But I'm hoping for 4 to 8 inches. I think the Park City Mountains could do as well as any part of the state with this storm this weekend. So fingers crossed for that. Winds have picked up overnight. You know, we had some strong winds on Tuesday and Wednesday, a little bit of a break yesterday, but winds have picked up overnight. Mid elevation, so like, for example, along the Park City Ridgeline, gusting around 30 miles an hour. 11,000 foot elevations, gusting in the 50s. So strong winds, that means it's moving some snow. And we had some wind drifting, some hard slabs on Tuesday and Wednesday. I'm going to have more wind drifting today. Some of your listeners may have heard there was an avalanche accident on the Park City Ridgeline yesterday. This occurred in an area just east of South Monitor Bowl. Skier triggered. The skier was caught and carried. Fortunately, they just emerged with some injuries. They were able to self-evacuate. And I don't know any details beyond. It was about 2 feet deep and 200 feet wide. UAC staff's going to go visit the site today and we'll know more. But I suspect it's one of those wind-drifted slopes. The winds we had on Tuesday and Wednesday, what happened is these slabs formed on top of some weak snow at the surface. So I think they can continue to be sensitive today. And we're going to have more wind drifting today. So we should see this new batch of fresh wind drifts that may be sensitive still. So we're going with an overall moderate danger, upper elevations all the way around, all aspects, primarily on north and east. I think that's where you can see these fresh wind drifts. And we're close to having our persistent weak layer problem being declared as dormant. Doesn't mean it's gone away, but just means it's unlikely. But the wind loading has placed a new load on it. So we're not ready to close the door on it yet. So if you do trigger an avalanche involving wind-drifted snow, it could step down into one of those deeper buried layers, 2 to 4 feet deep. So I think right now just try to avoid wind-drifted slopes. For once, just not great travel. And let's hope we'll get some snow out of this weekend, because we do have decent coverage, and it could just provide some excellent riding conditions. So fingers crossed we'll get some snow out of the system.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Coming up, we're going to have an interview that KPCW's Christine Weller did with Catherine Rainey Norman, the chair of Utah's Olympic Bid Committee. Then Pat Sweeney and Phil Jordan will join us to update us on the effort to build a Heber Valley Arts campus. And we're going to finish our hour by speaking with filmmakers Adam Brofman, Bruce Mao, and Bissy Williams about the new film, I Have a Name. Stay tuned. Well, KPCW's Christine Weller had a chance to speak with Catherine Rainey Norman, the chair of Utah's Olympic Bid Committee. Here's that interview.
Good morning. I'm KPCW's Christine Weller, and joining me today is Catherine Rainey Norman. She was the chair of Utah's Olympic Bid Committee and was instrumental in bringing the games back to Salt Lake City. You're a four-time Olympic speed skater, but you were originally a figure skater. How did you get into speed skating?
That is a fun question. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and started figure skating because I wanted to be like my big sister, and she got to have figure skating lessons. And so I started down the path of figure skating, and I would get up early in the morning before school to go and practice. And there were short track skaters that would skate on the outside of me, and I would skate on the inside and practice my jumps and all that sort of stuff. And this was at the Pettit National Ice Center, and they challenged me to a race. I was like 12-year-old girl. And these like 19 and 20-year-old boys challenged me to a race. And so I raced them and I won. And they went up to my mom and they were like, she's pretty good. Like, she should think about speed skating.
And you ended up competing in 4 Olympic Games. Did you have a favorite of the ones that you competed in?
Yeah, I certainly did. And you know, each one kind of had their own sort of unique moments for me. But by far, Salt Lake City was by far my favorite games. And I say that as coming from an athlete that participated, not being biased due to my role that I'm in now, but it was just such an honor to be able to compete here in the United States, coming from a small sport like speed skating, where, you know, we're lucky if we have 100, 200 fans that come out for an event, to then come to Utah and compete here and have stadiums full, you know, 6,000, 6,500 fans in the stands cheering USA nonstop, and just to have the games back in the United States. I remind people, like, you know, prior to 2002, the games were held in 1980 in Lake Placid, which I wasn't even born at that time, right? And I'm sure we have a couple of folks who are looking at 2034 saying, I wasn't even born in 2002. And so it's really a special, privileged opportunity to compete in your home country in the games.
You also eventually ended up coaching here in Utah in Kearns. Why did you end up going that route?
So I actually ended up coaching in Park City. So I coached the Park City Speed Skating Club, and it was a really small little club, and a fellow teammate of mine had started coaching there. And he said to me one day, he said, oh, I'm going to be out of town. Can you fill in for me? And I said, sure, no problem. I'll come fill in for you. And then the next week came around, he goes, actually, I need you to fill in again. I moved. And so I inherited the Park City Speed Skating Club. And it was, I would say it was like the little engine that could. And I had so much fun. It was so wonderful for me, especially as I had just retired and you know, still had such a love for the sport, to be able to sort of start to work in that area and to coach the kids. And so we grew the program. The program started initially with a lot of adults, and I coached for about 7 years up there. And by the time I left, we shifted from a primarily adult program to a primarily youth-based program, and then had athletes like Casey Dawson come out of that program to go on and excel on the Olympic stage. And so it was I'm so grateful to have been able to do that and to work with those families. And I still reference them as my kids, even though They're like grown adults. And I still follow them all to see how they're doing. Some are still competing. Some have grown on to do amazing things in different careers. But really just, I'm grateful that I was able to give back in that way. And really, I tried to set a tone with my kids that we always had three rules. First, number one, we're good sportsmen and women on the field of play, on and off the field of play. Number two, we have fun. And number three, we learn to skate.
Those are really great rules. And you've supported sport far beyond than coaching. You've had a big influence with fighting for things like comprehensive health care for Olympic athletes and safe training environments. I believe that was during your time on the Athletes Advisory Council. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about your work to fight for athlete support.
I've always had just sort of this mentality of how can we continue to improve the environment for our athletes, right? We should always be looking at how we can open up the doors for the next generation, make their environment that much better. And so I got involved in athlete advocacy kind of around like 2008-ish,
I think it was when I first started and had the opportunity again to rise to the vice chair of the Athletes
Commission for the United States, representing all sports, summer, winter, Olympic, Paralympic. And a lot of our focus at those times were ensuring holistic care for athletes on the medical side, making sure that athletes had opportunities off the field of play. So the athlete career and education program really championed that, creating an environment of focus around the holistic athlete. And then also, you know, just continued resources, financial support for athletes. So many athletes sacrifice so much to chase this dream, to represent their country. There are only a handful that go on to sort of be superstars and are able to make money. But a lot of athletes, even today, you know, they're couch surfing, they're working, you know, bartending jobs or any sort of flexible job that they can do to sort of save up their money. And so it's this continued effort to try to help improve those conditions so that they can continue to just focus on their sport so that they can truly represent our country.
Did your time as an athlete, was that a big influence on those types of initiatives?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I was competing, you know, athletes were really advocating for more resources, right? And I think you've seen over the course, you know, for sure in the last several years, right, the importance of name, image, and likeness and support for athletes, et cetera. You know, those are things that we have been championing for years and decades. And definitely we're starting to see the needle move, which is fantastic, right? A prime example of something that we've seen in recent years is obviously the focus on mental health and providing mental health resources to athletes. When I was an athlete competing, we didn't talk about that because you had a fear of maybe not being on the team or being cut or being viewed as less than. And you have athletes like Michaela and Simone and Lindsay and Michael Phelps, marquee athletes that are out there championing and saying it's okay to talk about this is really critical, really important. And so that advocacy part and trying to be an advocate to help pave a better path for our athletes is something that I'll probably do forever, I hope.
I want to talk a little bit more about the Olympics coming back to Utah in 2034. You've been working with the team to bring back the Olympics for quite a long time, it seems. Tell me a little bit more about what it's been like, those efforts to bring the games back.
Yeah, it's really been a over a decade-long effort for my own personal involvement in this regard. Governor Herbert was really the first person that brought together a group of stakeholders back in about, I think it was like 2010, 2011, he brought together a group of stakeholders. And I had the opportunity to serve as sort of the athlete voice in that regard. And that was really the first inkling of like, can we do this? What would we need to do this? All of that sort of stuff. And I would say say things really ramped up in 2018 when the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee designated Salt Lake City as America's choice. So when a future games were to come back to the United States, Salt Lake City was the choice city. The year was still TBD at that point in time, but since 2018, it's been a very concentrated and focused effort on when is the best time for Utah to host, and then putting forward our candidacy. And obviously the pandemic sort of delayed some things as well for us. And I think we learned some lessons through the pandemic. But when we pivoted into 2034 for the games, it really has begun to seamlessly align as to helping to not only bring the games back to Utah, but how do we look at elevating the Olympic and Paralympic movement across the entire United States. When you have Los Angeles in 2028, and now you have this sort of moment of continuous thread between Los Angeles into Utah, it really is a unique opportunity to elevate the profile of the movement holistically across the country and unify the country. Utah will play the canvas to this. We will play the lead act in this, but to also have that notion of ripple effect into the nation, I think is really important as well.
And you mentioned elevating, and that's kind of the theme for the 2034 Games. If I remember correctly, the three categories are kind of elevate athletes, elevate sport, elevate communities. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that theme and why there's been such a large focus on athletes.
Yeah, I think for us, we are in a unique position because we have all of our venues in place. Many of them, of course, they're going to need some refresh, right? We're still 9 years out. They're going to need a refresh, but we have our venues in place. And so we don't have to worry, are the venues going to be done in time? Are the lights going to turn on? Any of that sort of stuff. And so, again, this is such a unique opportunity for us in Utah to really think bigger about what our impact is going to be for a future games in 2034. What is our headline going to be? Quite frankly, I think it's going to be about how we have uplifted and or elevated our communities, sport and the athlete experience. From the athlete side, I've been out for the last 3 years meeting with athletes, listening to athletes, trying to understand how could we make their experience better. And the resounding piece of feedback has been, please help our families. So often athletes, they qualify for a games, 3-4 weeks in advance of the team showing up in the country, or families are trying to sort of roll the dice a bit, like maybe we should go in and get tickets and hotels, but we don't know if our child is going to make it. That causes a lot of stress for the athlete and for the families. And so for us, we are taking on that focus in helping them, working with wonderful partners to stand up an athlete family village, being able to bring volunteers in here in Utah, where we speak over 134 languages, have volunteers that can help athletes from or athlete families from across the world. This is a really, I think, a game changer for the movement. I think it beautifully aligns with the values here in Utah. We're a very family focused state, and we'll really, really have an impact. And again, when we think about our communities, what are our long-term goals from a community perspective, and how can the games have a lever to help expedite, to help collaborate, to help partner and try to get some of the big ideas within our communities accomplished? How can we engage all of our counties? We have a really great concept idea of what we're calling Project 29. There are 29 counties in Utah. How do we make sure that we broaden the reach of the Olympic and Paralympic movement and let somebody in Price or Kanab or St. George feel like they can have a piece and be connected into this incredible experience? And so this is a higher vision than what most organizing committees are focused on.
With the games coming back, Utah's Olympic Bid Committee has now dissolved and they're going to officially form an organizing committee. I was wondering if you had any updates on when the committee members will be announced or what that's looking like so far.
Yeah, happy to share a little update. So we are working in partnership with the U.S. Olympic Committee and the International Olympic Committee on standing up the organizing committee. We're back engaged in conversations with them, and I anticipate that you will see an organizing committee stood up and board and structure hopefully by the end of Q1 of this fiscal. There's just a lot of fundamentals that we're trying to put in place at this point in time. Make sure that we have a strong foundation for the next 9 to 10 years. And so it takes time, but it'll come together. And I anticipate, you know, whether it's end of Q1 or start of Q2, like it's coming, we're working on it, but we just want to be diligent.
All right. Well, that's everything. Thank you so much for meeting with me. I do really appreciate it.
No problem, Christine. Anytime.
We've been speaking with Catherine Rennie Norman, the former chair of Utah's Olympic Bid Committee.
Prosecutors in the Corey Richens case have admitted one piece of evidence was seized illegally during the murder investigation. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports both sides are arguing over just what a jury will hear in the highly anticipated murder trial.
The day Summit County Sheriff's deputies arrested the Camas mother of three in connection with her husband Eric Richens' 2022 death, they also seized an orange notebook during a search of the couple's home. Now prosecutors concede investigators didn't initially have a warrant to take the notebook they found May 8th of 2023. The issue was one of many evidentiary concerns discussed in 3rd District Court during a day-long hearing near Park City Thursday. The former real estate agent will stand trial for murder, attempted murder, and financial crimes in April, but first 3rd District Judge Richard Mrozek must decide which evidence can be presented in court. The contents of Corey Richens' notebook have not been disclosed, and it's not clear whether the information it holds is relevant to the case or furthered the murder investigation. Defense attorneys say in court documents the officers opened the notebook, read its contents, and then sought an amended warrant with the authority to seize it. They claim the contents are protected by physician-patient privilege because they were for Richens' therapist. Regardless, defense attorneys want Mrozek to toss it out as evidence. They contend that by taking it, investigators gleaned information they might not have otherwise known. If Mrozek agrees, that could open the door to disqualifying other evidence. Mrozek didn't make a ruling Thursday, and prosecutors are expected to argue in the coming weeks that deputies would have inevitably found the notebook or other evidence that it pointed them toward lawfully. That could get potentially tainted evidence back on the record. The defense team also wants the judge to toss out statements Richens made to authorities before her arrest, as well as evidence seized from her home, her person, her cell phones, and her Apple account. The defense is also asking that the so-called walk the dog letter be suppressed. Richens wrote it while in custody in 2023, and Summit County seized it, alleging she was asking her family to lie for her on the stand. Several Summit County Sheriff's Office employees and Clint Benson, Eric Richens' brother-in-law, took the stand Thursday. Attorneys will use the witness testimony and written arguments they'll submit to Mrozek ahead of a second hearing that could decide what evidence jurors will see. Separately, the Utah Supreme Court has taken up the question of whether to expand the jury pool to Salt Lake County. The Richens murder case has garnered local, national, and international media attention, so both sides are concerned about finding impartial jurors. The next hearing is February 3rd, when attorneys will present a draft jury selection questionnaire to Mrozek. Richens has been held in the Summit County Jail for nearly 2 years awaiting trial and has twice been denied bail. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, a new art center is about to rise out of the ground in Wasatch County. Here to talk to us about the Heber Valley Art Center is president of the Heber Valley Art Center, Phil Jordan, and development director, Pat Sweeney. So let's start with a little background. Talk to us about how long this project has been in the works.
Oh, it's been in development for 10 years, and it's an outgrowth of the Wasatch Arts Council, which is not part of the Wasatch government. It's something that the volunteers did on their own, and our mission is to support the arts in the county. Well, we had all the arts groups together, and everyone had the question, what can you do for us, Arts Council? And we said, well, what do you need? To a person, they now needed performance space, art space, display space for gallery art, because we have groups that are performing in a high school cafeteria, in a town center in a renovated 1900 building. So they needed someplace with lights, camera, and action more than anything. And we've been looking at it. We started with a group of 17 volunteers, community leaders, to help us organize it. Searched for land, couldn't find land, stepped back, reorganized this group, and we got the best place in the whole county.
And how did that come to be, Phil?
So over some period of time, we discovered that there's a opportunity on the entirety of the hill that you see on the eastern side of Heber Valley, which is Jordan L. Ridge, as it's known, and became the Jordan L. Ridge Development, as originally owned by the Sorensen family. And you know it because of the Utah Valley University campus, the Wasatch campus is there. And this is just up the hill from there. And it starts at River Road and goes all the way down to the new Smith's Marketplace. As that development moved forward with the economics and the opportunity for them to work together with the city on annexing it into Heber City, it became possible for there to be an arts district. 44 acres were declared as part of this and will be now gifted to Heber City for Heber City to develop essentially multiple facilities specific to the arts, as well as a trailhead to an amazing amount of new trails that are going in on that hill. So the Jordan L. Ridge Development firm did this deal with the city. We found out about it. We contacted them, and they said, we have a really great place for you to put this new arts center, and we have a better idea, we think, or not a better, but another idea called an amphitheater. So now we've envisioned the Sunset Ridge 3,500-seat amphitheater that will be host to local arts groups and touring groups coming into the valley to provide what cannot get to the market today.
Okay, so I take it the deal has been cut. Has the land already been committed to the city? And
that's correct.
And then you've agreed with the city to be the operator of that amphitheater.
We're in the midst of that right now.
Okay, so that's what you anticipate will happen.
That's correct.
That is what we anticipate. We've laid that out as a possibility when the city had its work session last week, mm-hmm. and we will be going back in February to seal the deal, as they say. But I think it makes total sense that we take a look at that whole spread that's up on the hill and have one group that operates everything.
Both the building that we wish to build, which is 55,000 square feet, which accommodates a 700-seat flexible theater, community room space for rehearsals, gallery space for artists, and that would be our project built on 4.4 acres, immediately adjacent to the new amphitheater.
Okay, so how long does it take to build something like an amphitheater?
Amphitheaters are not that complicated compared to larger facilities, but they will take, with the amount of dirt that has to be moved and then the structures that go in, approximately build period is only about 12 months once you get going, but the actual design period is about another 6 to 8 months on top of that or before that.
And you have to wait till this deal's finalized before you can start engaging vendors and architects and builders and those kinds of things.
Well, actually, we are working with some architects and mm-hmm. some design people in order to get that done. We've been working with them for the 55,000 square feet theater, mm-hmm. and now it just extends to the amphitheater. So what we want is for a look to be constant across the whole thing to complement the UVU campus, because when you come down Route 40 and you see to the left, you're going to see some structures up there, and you want them to be compatible.
As the city should, and wants to it as well. But it is a city project, so the amphitheater will need to go out to bid for architecture. But as Pat said, we've been working with Method Studios in Salt Lake, and they've done quite a bit of the arts facilities in the entire valley in the state for the better part of the last 15 years.
And if you think about a well-designed amphitheater, what are the characteristics that you're looking to capture? What makes this a good experience for the person who goes to see a performance?
Fun.
Okay.
If I could say it in one word,
sure.
It's fun, it's attractive, we bring the right acts in, and we are looking at designs that include fire pits for seating. So, you know, you'd have a group of six, you're sitting there in a lovely evening overlooking the Timpanogos Mountains, and you don't have to bring a blanket to warm up, but you're sitting there and it's like being in your living room watching somebody perform for you. So it will be... I think it's the best advertisement for the 55,000 square foot arts building that we're building, because when you come up and you see, okay, we're moving dirt over here, wow, this is an exciting, happening place. So,
Well, and operationally, the most important thing I think we feel up here in the mountains is access, that it doesn't take an hour to get there. And then everybody arrives at a different time, but they leave together. Mm-hmm. You don't want a 95 to 120-minute departure sequence, right? We're also very interested in how we engage our community, you know, developers around us in terms of what will be assets for essentially retail, but also restaurants. And connecting this facility down to downtown Heber, where Heber Main Street, as we're now learning, is a larger development idea. And then, of course, we're looking to the horizon of the 2034 Olympics and how we'd have events at the amphitheater, at the Arts Center, as well as Main Street, and be circulating essentially between the two. So all these aspects to your question ends up being, we want something that is accessible and fun, but also during the off hour or during the days that we're not on, we don't want this massive building up there. So we've conceived of this architecture to be actually in the mountain. And that, in fact, the stage would be the roof of the support building. So we're not looking at this big building sitting up there doing nothing the rest of the
week. And at the same time, we're building a building that we call the Jewel Room, because we believe we are sitting as the jewel of the mountain, because our venue looks out over the most amazing landscape that we can imagine. But we're building a Jewel Room, and that's going to be used for meet and greets with artists, and we're going to have community events in there. You can also have a small performing area, rehearsal space. All of this will complement what we have as the amphitheater, but also is essentially the first phase of building the theater building. Mm-hmm. So we'll have some place for everything. We can have wedding receptions there. It will be an amazing building, looking out over, again, the best view in the world.
And have you guys started to investigate how you program something like an amphitheater? In other words, for this to make sense, you've got to identify, book acts, and that's not an easy business. Have you guys started to investigate that?
No, it's not. There's several very active promoters in the market, as we know, and they live in venues that we love, of course, with what Red Butte has given us in that sort of scale. Certainly the larger venues that are national touring acts in 9,000, 10,000, 15,000 seats. And that market is, that business is developing in, as Salt Lake City and Salt Lake Valley develops. We are looking not to essentially copy that, but rather look at a smaller part of our opportunity with promoters to look at between 2,500 and 3,500 seats, and specifically look at acts that fit into that on an environment very similar to what we see already here with what we have being promoted and presented at the Egyptian, and or what we also see at our Eccles Center here. Mm-hmm. So that has proven that, in fact, the business can support that. As part of the Eccles Theater in Salt Lake City, we know that Broadway is very, very present and home, but concerts have actually been part of that business plan. And we've discovered that 2,500 seats in the right beautiful environment is a very attractive venue for a lot of acts that are touring around the country. So we're looking forward to that.
So what's it going to take to make it happen? What are you guys trying to, there has to be a need to raise some funds to get this thing done, I assume.
Well, we're looking at a number of opportunities that are out there. We're looking for public funds. We're looking for private donors, sponsors. We have a pie chart that kind of indicates where we're looking for this money. But we're out. We've hired a fundraising firm called Mighty Penguin out of Salt Lake, and they are assisting with raising $80 million.
That was what I was going to ask you.
As a development director, that's kind of a daunting figure, but I really do think it's accomplishable. We have a lot of money between Summit and Wasatch counties, as well as some very philanthropic organizations, some family trusts and legacy groups that are out there. The money is there. We've started it. We have some money in the bank already, so we're in a pretty good state. But there's always room for more, and as we grow and costs grow over the years, that's one of the big concerns, because costs escalate 4% a year. So if we've got a couple of years that we're waiting for, that money's going to need to be a little bit higher.
So the first phase, I take it, is, you said, is the amphitheater. What's the fundraising goal for that part of the project? Or do you look at it separately like that?
We do. And currently, with the deal that's been essentially part of the land deal between Jordan L. Ridge Development and the city and Raintree Development, those are the partners, the it's been essentially secured of $5 million as the original asset for the amphitheater. Our vision for a more full and more, I'd say, more pleasurable or long-term success of an amphitheater is sitting now at roughly $22 million. The differential between that being roughly that you can do the math.
I can do that.
Is going to be some part of more money from the development, and then, as Pat said, private sector donors. So we're looking more towards the private sector than we are for the public sector.
Is there grant money out there that you can try to use as part of this as well?
There are.
We've been lucky in the beginning. We've had some grants from both the state and the Sorensens for the developmental part of this. So we're very appreciative of that. Incredibly so, but we do know that there's a lot of grant money that's out there. We have applied for some. It takes a while to get noticed and get money awarded, but there's a good amount of money out there. But again, there are a good amount of, it is the most philanthropic area that I have ever seen in my life. I mean, people step forward and support so many different things, and we're lucky. We're lucky that we have a great big treasure chest to draw from.
And what's your timeline for getting the fundraising done so you can get shovels in the ground on this amphitheater?
You can answer that one, Phil, because our timeline varies for different things.
So we're hopeful that we can go into design starting in Q1, Q2 of this coming year, which means we'd be ready to actually break ground a year from now, which is just about right.
Wow.
The build period, we think, is about all in with getting up and operational about 10 months to a year. So we're looking for essentially in the spring of 2028 to be up and running. The Arts Center, we'd love to see right behind that. We'd love to build it concurrently. It'd be a lot more economic for us. But we are very much needing private support right now. We're here because we're looking for the visions, if you will, or visionary support of those that see how this can be a great asset for the community long term. These are 50-year buildings.
And where should people go to learn more if they want to engage and possibly support the center?
QBValleyArtsCenter.org, our website.
All right. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back after this. Part-time park guy Adam Bronfman is the producer of a new documentary film on the life of activist John Linton. Here to talk about it, we have Bronfman, and we also have Bruce Ma and Busy Williams of the Massive Change Network. Good morning. Thanks for being here, guys.
Good morning.
Okay, let's start by sharing with the audience a bit about Linton. Adam, can you tell us a little bit about how you became aware of his work?
Actually, he was doing a fundraiser on Facebook, and he was a friend. We had sort of lost touch, and he had gone through a crisis during the great financial crisis, lost his business, and so had a workmate of his who descended into drug addiction, went onto the street, and died. And he started doing a photography project to bring images of people on the street to people to bring an awareness of what's going on in the unhoused situation in Phoenix. And that led to a philanthropist donating a bus where he could do this amazing amount of giving. And he was doing a project, a fundraiser on Facebook for that, and led me through his project, his photography, and I went down and got on the bus.
And that was sort of the beginning, and that led you to want to make a film out of this, I take it.
Exactly. I decided other people needed to be able to see through the eyes of John Linton, to have a sense of compassion and an understanding of what's going on in our world, where, because we tend to hide the homeless or the unhoused population, particularly, that's a particular crisis in Phoenix. And I wanted people to be able to look through his eyes, see the compassion in his heart, and be able to reach their own compassion, because that's what happened to me. So I made this documentary, and when we decided to how we were going to try and distribute it, we went to Bruce and BC and said, you have a relationship with ASU, Arizona State University. We would like to do the premiere there. And their reaction to the documentary was quite extraordinary.
Well, Danielle was kind enough to share a screener with me last night, so I got to spend some time with the film last night. And one of the things that's extraordinary about it, as you know, if you think about the documentaries, is not only the story about what's going on and watching John relate to these people. The name of the documentary is "I Have a Name." In one of the early sequences, John is saying to somebody, "What is your name?" And the reaction is, no one's asked me that for years. But also the photography. Can we talk a little bit about John's photography? Because it's unusual in a documentary like this to sort of combine the interaction with the unhoused, and his extraordinary photographs.
One of the things I think that happens in John's work and the images that he's produced, because they're stills in a film, you get to look at them directly. You get to look at them for a long time. And it allows us, through his eyes, as Adam said, to actually see the humanity in the people who are, you know, in this condition. And to realize, you know, there but for the grace of God. You know, we're all a few steps away from that cliff. And so really to think about how to connect the emotional, you know, make the emotional connection, and not just the information connection. You know, it's more than the data. You know, last year 650 people died on the streets in Phoenix. I mean, it's a serious crisis. But that's not, you know, the data isn't what moves us. John's humanity moves us, and that's what we're trying to do with our work.
And go ahead, sir.
Well, and I would add that there's also artistry. Everyone has a gift, and John is an entrepreneur and an artist. And when I look at that film, there's sort of a tradition. If you go, you see John holding the gaze, not exploiting, but actually these photos are beautiful of people in an incredibly vulnerable position, and he gives them that grace. And you go back to Andy Warhol in his 15 minutes. If you remember, he had everyone hold their paws for 15 minutes. And then you go back to Chris Marker and Kurosawa, and there's a sequence where they hold the film for 30 minutes, and you're just looking at Kurosawa's face before he starts filming. There's a tradition there, which is a bit of meta in there, but that also is what brings the beauty and the beauty of humanity, and then it opens up something in us to do something different, use your own gifts in a different way.
There are a lot of sequences where the camera shows John interrelating with homeless people, and these people are vulnerable. How difficult was it to get them to accept the notion that you were going to photograph them, that you were going to film them?
I think that if we didn't have the bus, right, which brings the message of let's be better humans into the mix, and then John is a man with an extraordinary heart, and he feels safe. And so he, with him as the leader, people really felt, and many people, you know, we don't show the people who are like,
no,
please
right?
go away, I don't yeah. want to have anything to yeah. do with you. But I think that John brings a safety so that people are willing to be vulnerable. And I think that's one of the special things, the ability to be vulnerable and to tell our story and then to look at the world the way we are and how it is. And I think that's what motivated Bruce and BC, is saying there is a story here that connects with our vulnerability so that we can look at the way the world is. And they're designers who say there's another way, and we can work together in order to create a world that looks a little bit different from the way it looks today.
I want to share some more snippets, because to help people understand why it's so interesting and why you want to get into this film. Adam, there's a wonderful sequence about showers. can one of you sort of talk about that a little bit?
The shower scene broke my soul. It just struck me how basic our needs are, but how big love is and care. And that idea of care, that moment where John was like, I'm tired, I want to go home, I've had it, and he's been giving and giving and giving. He took a beat And then all the boys had showers. And the gratitude that was expressed of just a simple act that we do every day. And to be given the grace to be clean and to have that dignity restored and refreshed, that was the turning point for me in the movie, where whatever it takes, my eyes are open, I can't look away, what can I do? And I have children. I mean, as a mother, it broke my heart. And I don't want other mothers' hearts to be broken. And I don't want other children to feel so exposed, so uncared for. It was amazing.
How long did it take to shoot the film, Adam, and edit it? So how long was the production process?
It took a while. Yeah. So we did the two and a half week journey on the bus that went from Phoenix to L.A. up all the way to Oregon through San Francisco and Oakland and then back. And then we did a series of interviews with John in order to, and it was amazing the way he was able to emote. And then the editing process took a long time because I had a very specific vision of what I wanted to show. And it was until I went and connected with Eric Vaughn, our director, who was not my original concept of the director. He and I had worked so much before in another project that we were able to connect, and he knew what I wanted to do, and he brought himself to it. And then we had a wonderful post-production team that worked together. And so it took 3 years okay. to put the thing all the way together. And then, you know, this is a very complicated story because it's not a for-profit documentary, right? It's a not-for-profit message to the world that there is a population out there that we have, that our society, right, doesn't really look at. And it was really going to Bruce and BC to say, what do you think we should do with this?
It's really important to understand that the film is the beginning, not the end.
Thank you.
So for a lot of documentary makers, the film is the destination. But for Adam and Theorem and for our work, the film is a catalyst to begin the impact. So our work is really about, you know, we consider ourselves actionists, not only activists, you know, calling attention to a problem, but actually undertaking the design of solutions. So we now have, working with the film as a kind of catalyst, we have a program at ASU on the unhoused, working with the community on new solutions, and really thinking of it not as a problem, but as an ecosystem. So how do we design the ecosystem of the unhoused? So instead of thinking of it as a kind of discrete entity that we need to kind of, you know, put that one solution in, let's think of it as an ecology and really understand what's driving this situation. How do we get to a situation where 650 people die in the street?
So your organization is called Massive Change.
Massive Change Network.
Okay, yeah. So we have the film, we have a program at the university, and I take it, is that something students sign up for, or is it?
Yeah, it's
okay,
a program.
Of course,
yeah.
Right. And where are you going with this? I mean, what are your goals, both short-term and long-term?
So this is really intergenerational work. This is societal work. We are going to Washington, D.C. We have a consortium of universities that are also working on the unhoused. We'll be in Chicago. We're taking it to Canada as well. And the idea is open everyone's eyes. What can we do? What's possible? And we believe that there are solutions. It's sort of a local, global thing. But the idea is really, can we design ourselves to be better humans and wake up the better human in ourselves and not disregard our fellow citizens.
So it's interesting, in terms of, this is not a traditional, I'm going to distribute this documentary and that's that. It is sort of part of an integrated program that you're trying to go to various, and have you booked out a number of appearances over the next year or so?
Yeah, we're going, actually next month we're going to be in D.C. We're going to do two events in D.C. In the fall we're going to be in New York. And this is all based on, and working with entrepreneurs, philanthropists, and universities in order to create this ecosystem where we look at the design of the world and the communities we live in, and how do we redesign in a way that makes sense and is coming from this idea of education and implementation. And this is not something that I thought about, and this was not why I made it. We sent it to Bruce in DC because of their connection to ASU, and Bruce said, this is a catalyst. This is a catalyst. This work that you've done, Adam, is something that can inspire people to look within themselves and to try and figure out a way to enhance society, to redesign what we have to make our world a better place.
So the education, obviously, is a first step. The big challenge is coming up with the solutions.
Mm-hmm. But that's what the education is producing.
Right.
So at ASU, our charter says we will take responsibility for our community. Not to advise them, not to help them, not to, you know, all the other possible words, but take responsibility. Yeah. So if 650 people are dying, we're responsible for that. That we've designed it that way.
Yeah.
And we have to lean into solving it.
The film is I Have a Name. Is it going to be screened this week?
We're doing an event at the Impact Lounge tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love everybody to come. It's in Prospector. We'll be screening parts of the film, and then we will be doing an exercise where people can participate in these ideas that are generated from massive change.
We've been speaking with Adam Bronfman about the film I Have a Name, and we've also been speaking with Bruce Ma and Bissy Williams of the Massive Changement Network. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.